I want you to start by picturing two objects, and on the surface, they have absolutely nothing in common.
Okay.
In your left hand, imagine you're holding a pearl. It's organic, fragile, it has that shimmering, iridescent surface, you know, a literal gem.
Right. Something delicate, maybe a little old-fashioned, luxury.
Exactly. Now, in your right hand, imagine a steel cable, the kind that hoists an elevator up a skyscraper. It's cold, heavy, greased.
Total industrial grit. Unyielding. It smells like a machine shop.
That's the assumption, anyway. But the whole mission of this deep dive is to prove that those two things, the pearl and the steel cable, are, well, they're practically siblings.
It's such a wild connection. We're going to be talking about a specific microstructure in steel called perlite.
And to really get it, we have to bridge this this huge gap between 19th century geology and modern day structural engineering.
Yeah, it's a journey that traces how a name for volcanic rock ended up describing the very backbone of the modern world. We're going from inside a volcano to under a microscope in Victorian England.
And we've got the sources to prove it. We're looking at historical accounts from Henry Clifton Sorby. He's the heavy hitter in this sort of technical diagrams. And some really interesting notes on scientific integrity.
That note is actually crucial. It's about the discipline of seeing what's really there, not just what you want to see. It's about not letting the excitement of a discovery get ahead of the proof.
So let's jump in. We have to start with the name itself. Perlite. Now, if I had to guess, I'd say a metallurgist saw some shiny steel, thought it looked pretty, and, you know, named it after a pearl.
And you'd be right, eventually.
Yeah.
But the origin is way messier. The word perlite, and notice the spelling, P-E-R-L-I-T-E, it didn't start with metal at all.
It started with rocks.
It started with rocks. We had to go back to 1822. There was a French mineralogist, François Sulpice Boudon. He was translating a German term, perlstein.
Which means?
Literally pearl stone.
Simple enough.
And he coined perlite to describe these specific volcanic rocks from extinct volcanoes in Hungary. They were glassy things, obsidian and pitch stone. They had these little concentric cracks that made them look like tiny pearls or onions.
So if you said perlite back then, you were talking about a glassy rock you'd find near a volcano. Mm. Nothing to do with a steel beam.
Not at all. It was completely geological. And this is where our sources throw a massive curveball. One of the people using this exact term was Charles Darwin.
I honestly did a double take when I saw his name in the notes for this. I mean, you don't associate the origin of species guy with the steel industry. He's looking at finches, right?
Right. But before he was the evolution guy, he was a geologist. During the voyage of the Beagle, he was obsessively cataloging volcanic islands.
Okay, that makes sense.
And he actually used Boudon's term in his journals. He described seeing these little brown spherulitic globules in the rocks on Ascension Island.
Spherulitic globules.
It's a mouthful. He called it perlite lithoid globulaire. But the point is, for most of the 19th century, this was a rock term. It had nothing to do with the Industrial Revolution.
So how do we make that jump? We've got volcanoes, Darwin on an island, and then suddenly we're talking about the strongest steel in the world. Who builds that bridge?
The hero of our story is a man named Henry Clifton Sorby. And if you're into material science at all, Sorby is basically the godfather.
The sources call him the father of metallography.
That's the one. He started out as a rock guy, just like Darwin. But he hit a wall with the technology. See, back then, to study a rock under a microscope, you used transmitted light.
So you'd slice the rock super thin, put it on a slide, and shine a light through it.
Exactly. Works great for translucent minerals. But Sorby wanted to look at iron and steel. And steel has one big problem for that method.
It's opaque. You can't shine a light through an I-beam.
You can't. So Sorby had to flip the entire script. He developed a technique using reflected light. He'd take a piece of steel, polish it to a flawless mirror, and then this is the key, he'd etch it with acid.
Wait, why the acid? If he just polished it to a perfect mirror, wouldn't that just ruin it?
That's the entire point. Steel isn't just one uniform thing. It's a mixture of different ingredients, and the acid eats away at them at different rates.
Ah, so it creates a topography, little ridges and valleys that show the structure.
Precisely. And then he'd shine a light onto that surface and look at what bounced back. And that is when he saw it.
The pearly compound.
Under about 650x magnification, he saw that the steel wasn't solid gray. It was striped. These incredibly fine alternating parallel lines, sometimes straight, sometimes curved like a fingerprint.
And he knew these weren't just polishing scratches.
He realized it was two distinct materials, layered. One was soft iron, which we now call ferrite. The other was this very hard, brittle substance we call cementite.
So it's a laminate, like microscopic plywood.
A natural laminate. And the way the light played off those ridges, it reminded him of a pearl. It had that same kind of luster.
I want to pause on this because the sources make a huge deal about Sorby's reaction. Today, if you find something cool, you post it instantly. Hey, look at my striped steel. But he didn't do that.
No, and it's this fascinating insight into his character. He saw the lines, and he wrote later that he felt almost certain about what they were. But he also said the facts were so extraordinary that he refused to publish.
He just sat on it.
For months. Yeah, for months. Mm-hmm. He didn't want to be the guy who hyped up some hunch and got it wrong. He spent months looking at every kind of iron he could find, meteoric iron, different steels, just to confirm this structure was real and consistent.
So that is some serious scientific discipline.
It's the difference between a hunch and actual science.
Mm-hmm.
He wouldn't claim a discovery until the data basically forced him to.
Okay, so once he's sure, he names it perlite. But why does it look like a pearl? Why does this chunk of gray metal look like a gemstone?
This is where we get into the physics of it. The physics of iridescence. To understand the steel, we have to understand the oyster.
Okay, walk us through the oyster.
A natural pearl is made of nacre. And nacre is built in layers, like a microscopic brick wall. You have these hexagonal platelets of a mineral called aragonite. And they're separated by this thin layer of organic glue.
And the key is the thickness of those plates.
Exactly. The aragonite plates are about 0.5 micrometers thick.
Which is tiny.
It's tiny, but it's a very specific kind of tiny. It's roughly the same size as the wavelength of visible light.
Okay, I think I remember this from high school physics. Interference patterns.
You got it. When light hits those layers, some reflects off the top, but some goes through and reflects off the layer below it. And because the spacing is just right, those reflected waves crash into each other.
Right. Some cancel out. Some get amplified.
And that amplification creates the shimmering colors, the iridescence. That's why a pearl seems to glow.
Okay, so back to the steel. It's not transparent, so how does that work?
Remember the acid etching?
It created ridges. It
created what's called a diffraction grating.
Yeah.
You have alternating ridges of hard cementite and valleys of soft ferrite. The spacing between those ridges is so small that it interferes with the light waves bouncing off, just like the layers in the pearl.
So it's not just a poetic name. It's actually playing the same optical trick as a real pearl.
It is nature repeating a design pattern in two completely different worlds. One in the ocean, the other in a furnace.
That's an amazing connection. But I'm seeing a logistical problem in the timeline. Sorby sees this in the 1860s. He can't just snap a photo on his phone. How does he prove to anyone what he's seeing?
This is the big challenge, right? Visualizing the invisible. Before Sorby, in Austria, they used a technique called nature printing for meteorites.
Nature printing? That sounds like using a leaf and some paint.
It's kind of like that, but way clever. They'd polish a meteorite, etch it really deeply so the pattern was raised, like a rubber stamp, and they'd ink the metal itself and press it onto paper.
So the meteorite literally became the printing plate.
The meteorite was the printing plate. But you can't do that with perlite. The lines are microscopic. If you tried to ink it, you'd just get a gray smudge.
You need magnification.
Exactly. So between 1863 and 1865, Sorby hires a photographer in Sheffield, and they have to physically rig a camera to a microscope. I mean, it must have been an incredible challenge.
The birth of photomicrography.
And it took them 20 years to really perfect it. One of the sources has this 1887 paper with what is arguably the first published photomicrograph of perlite. And it just changed the game. Suddenly, other scientists could see the data for themselves.
And once you can see it and name it, you have to argue about how to classify it.
It's a great name game of metallurgy.
The reading points to Henry Marion Howe. He's the one who formalized the names, right? Ferrite, cementite, and perlite.
Howe was the great systematizer. He looked at Sorby's work and said, okay, let's put some rules on this. The pearl suffix is straight from mineralogy, like hematite, pyrite.
Sure.
But Howe ran into this huge headache when he tried to map out when perlite actually forms in the steel.
This is the phase diagram stuff, the map of what steel does at different temperatures.
Right. In chemistry, there's a term called eutectic. A eutectic point is the specific mixture of ingredients that melts at the lowest possible temperature. It's when a liquid turns into two solids at the same time as it cools.
But perlite isn't forming from a liquid. It's forming when the steel is already solid.
Exactly. It's a solid state transformation. One solid crystal turns into two other solid crystals.
Yeah.
So Howell looked at this and said, you know, I can't call this eutectic. That implies melting. It's wrong.
So he needed a new word.
He took eutectic and added the suffix eoid. eutectoid.
Which means resembling or taking the form of, like, humanoid.
Exactly. Android, asteroid. It's brilliant. It tells you this acts like a eutectic reaction, but it happens entirely in the solid state.
And he found that sweet spot, the eutectoid composition, at around 0.9% carbon.
Around there. The early diagrams debate it, maybe 0.8%, 0.9%. But that's the magic recipe where the entire steel structure transforms into this perfect perlite laminate. Nothing left over. Just 100% layered strength.
Speaking of recipes, we have to talk about the Russians. Because while the British and Americans were arguing over names, the Russians were figuring out the geometry of the thing.
You can't tell this story without Dmitry Chernov and Colonel Beliau.
Colonel Beliau. He sounds like a character in a spy novel.
The serious metallurgist. While everyone else was mapping temperatures, Bully was obsessed with the 3D structure. He was actually jealous of meteorites.
Jealous of a rock from space?
Well, think about how a meteorite cools. It's in the vacuum of space, cooling down over millions of years. That lets the crystals inside grow to be massive. You can see them with the naked eye.
And Beliau wanted to do that with spiel, make giant perlite.
He thought if he could cool steel slowly enough, the perlite layers would grow big enough to see without a microscope. He didn't quite get there, but in the process, he had this breakthrough about what he called stereometry.
Stereometry? Sounds complicated.
It's just 3D visualization. He noticed that under the microscope, the perlite lines weren't all the same thickness. Sometimes they were thick, sometimes they were razor thin.
And that's confusing, right? If it's the same material, the layer should be uniform.
Think of a deck of playing cards. That's your perlite. If you slice the deck straight down, vertically, what do you see?
The thin edges of the cards. Thin lines.
Right. But what if you slice through that deck at a really shallow diagonal angle?
Oh, I see. The exposed edges of the cards would look much wider.
The material isn't changing, the viewing angle is. Beliau realized that what you see in the microscope is just a random 2D slice of a 3D object. It seems obvious now, but it was a crucial insight.
It's a great reminder that you're looking at a slice of a much bigger world. Okay, so we've got the geology, the microscopy, the physics, the geometry. Let's get to the so what question. Why does this pretty layered structure matter to someone getting into an elevator today?
It matters because perlite is essentially the world's most successful composite material.
Composite like fiberglass.
Exactly like fiberglass, you have a matrix and a reinforcement. In perlite, the ferrite layers, the soft iron, are ductile. They can bend and stretch.
That's the shock absorber.
And then you have the cementite layers, iron carbide. That stuff is incredibly hard and strong, but it's brittle. A pure bar of it would snap like glass.
So you sandwich them together.
You sandwich at a microscopic level. The soft ferrite stops the hard cementite from cracking, and the hard cementite stops the soft ferrite from stretching too much. You get massive strength, but you also get flexibility.
And where do we see that in action?
The classic example is wire rope.
Ropes for cranes and bridges.
Yeah. I mean, you go back to the 4th century, they're describing cranes using ropes made of hemp. They rotted, they snapped. They were a nightmare.
Not great for lifting giant stone blocks.
Not at all. Then in the 1830s, Wilhelm Albert invents twisted wrought iron ropes for mining. Better, but still not what we have today.
And then comes perlite.
Today, the steel and suspension bridge cables, elevator cables, even the cords in your car tires, it's almost all cold-drawn perlitic steel.
What does cold-drawn do?
It takes those little random colonies of perlite, the stacks of cards facing every which way, and it stretches them out. It yanks the wire through a die, aligning all those little laminate plates so they're parallel with the wire itself.
So it turns the microstructure into billions of continuous aligned filaments.
That's it. So when you're driving over a huge suspension bridge, those main cables,
yeah,
they're not solid bars of iron. They are bundles of these microscopic aligned pearly layers.
And that's what's holding you up.
That is what's holding you up. It's the only material cheap enough and strong enough to do the job. Without perlite, we wouldn't have skyscrapers, and we certainly wouldn't have elevators to get to the top.
It really is the synthesis of everything. We started with a volcanic rock, moved to a guy in Sheffield, just wanting to see what steel looked like, and that curiosity led to the engineering marvels that define our world.
It's the unreasonable effectiveness of curiosity. Sorby didn't set out to build a better bridge. He just wanted to know what steel was.
I think that leads us to a really great final thought. We look at our cities, at the steel beams and cables, and we just see this dull, gray, industrial stuff. We think utility.
We don't really stop to admire the aesthetic of a brake cable.
Right. But maybe we should. Because if you had eyes that could see at the microscopic level, that gray cable wouldn't look gray at all.
No, it would look like a landscape, a complex, layered, iridescent landscape that mimics the hidden beauty of a pearl. The beauty is there. It's just hiding in the scale.
So next time you step into an elevator or drive over a bridge, take a second to thank Henry Clifton Sorby and the pearly layers holding you up. That's it for this deep dive. Thanks for listening.